Good morning. It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back next week. Well, 121 years ago today, we saw one of the darkest incidents in the history of the United States, the Wounded Knee Massacre. We're going to talk about that event this morning with Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College and author of the book Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. Professor Richardson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, John.
The events at Wounded Knee have been recounted numerous times, but probably there are still some people who don't really know what happened there. Let's start with the event itself, but I'd like us to spend quite a bit of the hour talking about the things that were taking place in the United States at that time that made such an event inevitable.
Well, the larger story is certainly interesting, but what we are celebrating is the wrong word, but what today is the anniversary of is, of course, the massacre itself. And it truly was a massacre. On the night of December 28th in South Dakota, the Army, and we can talk a little bit about why the Army was even in South Dakota, but the Army had managed to capture a band of Minneconjou Lakota, or Sioux, that were trying desperately to run across the state of South Dakota from the north to the south to take shelter with Red Cloud, who was one of America's great Indian leaders. And they, for various reasons outside of their control, of the Minneconjou's control, the soldiers perceived, and this, and the officers perceived them as being dangerous and hostile. They were not. But finally, on the night of December 28th, or the evening of December 28th, about 4 o'clock, the Army finds them, and they surrender. They surrender unconditionally. Their leader is very, very ill with pneumonia. And they go back to the Army encampment on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. That night, because this group is considered hostile, a number of additional Army units come in and surround them on very low-rise hills around the Army encampment. And when they do that, one of the units to come in is the 7th Cavalry. When the 7th Cavalry comes in, it brings with it the highest-ranking military officer, a man named Forsyth. He has been in the field during the Civil War, but mostly he's been a desk general since the Civil War, and he really has never worked successfully with Indians. He's actually got kind of a bad past in that. So he takes over, and the morning of December 29th, he is absolutely determined to disarm the Indian men who are there. They, on the other hand, are determined not to be disarmed because one of their real complaints with the U.S. government is that they are being starved to death. If they lose their guns, their very expensive, nice Winchesters, they're not going to be able to hunt, and they're not going to be able to survive the upcoming winter. They're right on the cusp, of course, of the worst season in South Dakota. So there's a huge struggle that goes on for, you know, a couple of hours about the disarming of especially the young men. As this struggle goes on, Forsyth gets angrier and angrier. And you have to remember that all of what's going on is going on through interpreters because very few of the Army officers are familiar with Lakota and very few of the Lakota are familiar with English. So they've got a number of interpreters going back and forth who have their own agenda. While they are arguing back and forth, finally, Forsyth gets angry enough that he separates the women and the children, and he says that the men are going to have to be go one by one and be disarmed. That doesn't go very well. When along about the fourth or fifth or sixth guy going through, says, "Wait a minute, you are not going to take my gun." He holds it above his head. He says, "You know, I paid good money for this sucker." He doesn't use the word sucker, of course. "I paid good money for this gun, and if you want to pay me for it, you can have it, but you're not going to take it away from me." The soldiers were actually writing on the guns which one of them were going to take the guns once they took them away from the Indians. He says, "You're not going to have it." Three soldiers jump him from behind and start struggling with him for control of the gun. He holds it up, and as they struggle, the other soldiers surround them, pointing their guns at these struggling four men. One of the interpreters screams, "Look out, look out, they're going to shoot." Right then, as the struggle goes on, the gun goes off, pointing into the sky. With that, Forsyth screams, "Shoot, shoot them all." And the soldiers start to shoot. When they do that, the Indians are, for the most part, unarmed. They mow down a lot of the Indians in the council area. Unfortunately, the soldiers were also arranged in a circle, so they managed to shoot a lot of their own people. After that, the Indians run. The women and the children try and escape in wagons, and the men, for the most part, because of the peculiar geography of the region, end up in this shallow ditch, dry ditch, called the ravine. And the army trains mountain cannons down the ravine and on the fleeing wagons. So over the course of the next hour or so, most of the Indians in that area are killed. The ones who manage to crawl through the ravine and get out the other side are hunted down by the soldiers over the course of the next 3 hours. And at the end of the day, between 250 and 300 of the surrendering Minneconjou were dead. That's virtually all of them. We don't have the exact number because the next night or that night, a blizzard came down and covered the field. When that happened, a lot of their kin came in and took both bodies and wounded from the battle area. So we don't actually have a clean count, but we believe it's about 270 people.
This, what was it that made that created the idea that these people were a threat? I mean, this group of 350 Minneconjou was a majority of them were old men, women, and children.
Yes.
Why did the soldiers who were there? The accounts that I've read of this all suggest that these soldiers were really nervous. They were very tense. They really thought that these people were a threat to go into battle almost at any moment. What was it that created that idea?
Well, of course, there's sort of the long history of distrust that people feel for others, and let's just put that out there that everything I'm going to say is not going to be predicated on the idea that the soldiers were not racist, were not upset about having to deal with Indians. That needs always to be on the table when you talk about American history. But what happened at Wounded Knee was very closely tied to a number of other issues, political and economic issues, that created a very bizarre, peculiar situation that made these particular Indians appear to be dangerous. Now, the group of the Minneconjou who end up being massacred, what is truly astonishing, and the work that I've done on them has been the hardest work I've done, and I've written a number of books, but because you could watch these people, both the soldiers and the officers and the Minneconjou, as I did my research, every day I could see that they were walking to the edge of a cliff and I couldn't stop them. The Minneconjou who end up being massacred are really the most unlikely targets of what's happening in South Dakota in 1890 that you can imagine. The reason that the Army perceives them as a real problem in mid-December is because there is a completely different group of Lakota who have taken fright at the Army. The Army actually goes into South Dakota in mid-November of 1890. When that happens, there's a group of Indians in the southern reservations who panic, and they run. They run to the Badlands, and they run and they hole up in the Badlands. And they're talking a big game, some of them. Mostly they're incredibly frightened, and they're hoping that the Army's going to go away. But they are perceived as being hostile. The Army perceives them as being hostile, and some of them are. They're not very powerful. But they're holed up in the Badlands. So when the Minneconjou take incredible fright at the murder of Sitting Bull, which happens in mid-December, they take a look at the fact that the Army murders Sitting Bull and says, geez, if they're going after Sitting Bull, it's only a question of time till they come after us. They panic, and they start to run to the south, as I say. The way the path ran through South Dakota, that made them look as if they were going to join the men in the Badlands. They weren't. There was never any evidence that they were going to. But South Dakota was a big state. It was a brand-new state. Nobody knew where anything was. The Army, in fact, is the Army officer in charge of finding them, writes these plaintive notes to his superiors going, I can't find anything out here. The Indians are the ones who know where everything is. For all I know, they're not even in this state any longer. So when these guys start to run, they are perceived to be going to the Badlands, and the Army has been negotiating with the guys in the Badlands for months, or weeks anyway, and they are on the verge of surrendering. So the idea is if the Minneconjou actually go to them and tell them that Sitting Bull has been murdered, there really will be a war. So because of this weird confluence of geography, the murder of Sitting Bull, the guys out in the Badlands, it looks to the Army officers like they have simply got to pull this band of Minneconjou away from everybody else. In fact, as you say, they're older men. There's some young men, but they're mostly old men, women, and children, and their leader is dying of pneumonia. The reason nobody can find them is because they're moving so slowly. The Army's looking in the wrong place. So they are a really unlikely band, but they're in absolutely the wrong place at the wrong time.
Let's. You mentioned the leader. You're talking about Bigfoot, I believe, is how he was referred to. He was actually being sought by the Indians at Pine Bluff because of his skills as a negotiator. Didn't they want him to be there so that he could help with the negotiations?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's another one of the great ironies. He was known as one of the great negotiators, and again, one of the ironies of the fact that it is him and his family and his band that gets destroyed is that he has walked an incredibly fine line in the troubles of South Dakota, managing to keep on good terms both with the Army officer overseeing him, who gets he isn't part of all this. He's still up in the Northern Reservation where all this happens, and with his own young men, who are furious with what's going on around them and are talking about fighting. And he manages to negotiate that. He has a very good reputation as a negotiator. And in the trouble of trying to get the Indians from the Badlands back to the Pine Ridge Reservation, actually the Indians on the Pine Ridge Reservation invite him to come help with the negotiations to protect the guys coming in from the Badland, and they offer him quite a good fee to do it. He is initially inclined not to do it because he doesn't want to get in trouble with his own Army officer with whom he has a good relationship, who says, no, you're staying put up here. But when his young men say, we're going with or without you, he decides that he's better off staying with them and being able to influence what they do than just simply turning them loose. So the poor man's trying to do the best he possibly can, and he's actually sort of pouring oil on the waters, and ironically, he's one of the first to die.
Do you think it would have, and obviously speculating 121 years after the fact, but had he been healthy, had he not been suffering from pneumonia, which, I mean, if you've ever had it, it's a debilitating illness. I mean, you really don't have any strength to do anything. Breathing is an effort. If he had not been ill, would that have made a difference here?
Well, you know, the what-ifs are interesting. He not only couldn't breathe, he was bleeding heavily from the nose and mouth. Would it have made a difference? Absolutely. Because the thing that starts the whole set of panic telegrams is the fact he is supposed to report to his own Army officer, and he promises up and down that he's going to. When the refugees from Sitting Bull's camp run to his camp, they are perceived to be hostile, and he says to the Army officer, you know, chill out. I'll bring them back to you tomorrow, and we'll hash this all out. And he doesn't do it. And he doesn't do it because he's too ill to get out of his bed. But this, his officer interprets as the fact he is siding with hostility rather than continuing to make peace. And the Army officer himself doesn't check in on Bigfoot. He sends soldiers down, who of course go back to him and say, ah, he's just being recalcitrant, he won't show up. But you know, I do want to emphasize this is not only a story about contingency. You know, other people have said, one of the people that I complain about at great length is Benjamin Harrison, and somebody said, well, any president would have done it. And my answer to that is no. There are large conditions that are set up that set things in motion. Within that motion, there are contingencies. You know, the gun went off. Bigfoot got pneumonia. You know, Sitting Bull's worst enemy was the guy who ended up being asked to arrest him. You know, all those sorts of things are the little pieces that fall into place, but there's a larger train of events that's set into place that makes things happen. So did his illness matter? In the short term, it obviously did, but nothing good was going to happen to the Sioux in South Dakota in 1890, whether or not Bigfoot got pneumonia.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more about this tragic episode in United States history It is the today is the 121st anniversary of the massacre at Wounded Knee. Wondering what comments or questions you might have about this. You can get in touch with us. Three different ways to do it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show page on Facebook and leave a comment there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. My guest this hour is Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College and author of the book Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. We're talking about what happened at Wounded Knee on December 29th, 1890. 121 years removed from the tragedy, it is still widely debated and widely discussed. And there are still repercussions even today. So that's why we're here, to talk about this. And we have full phones. As soon as I gave the phone number, I knew the phones would light up. So we have a lot of people who would like to talk about Wounded Knee. And let's take a call right now. We'll start in Viola with Eugene. Eugene,
good morning. Good morning, Professor. I read your book, and you did a good job on that. And about the only thing I have to contribute is I taught out there at Wounded Knee, which is Manderson School District, for a year. I was on and off those reservations over about 30-year period, pretty much. And we didn't really have a good understanding, I don't think, of the culture of the Native Americans. For instance, particularly with education, when they set the religious order, set up some of the schools out there, and they set it up a conventional white man's school. Well, if you've got a conventional white man's school, you can do a lecture or demonstration, and you can do question and answer. We are a competitive society. But if you're doing Native American or an Indian school, you're working in an Indian school, you can do a lecture or demonstration, but you can't do question and answer because they are a cooperative society and they will not compete with each other in a classroom for question and answers.
Oh, huh.
It just won't happen, pretty much. But I was Rosebud Reservation for 5 years, from 75 until 80.
Oh, wow.
And that, I'll tell you that, I got along good as a kid. I was working 7th and 8th grade math, and teenagers are teenagers the world over. I don't care what race, color, creed, religion, or what. And I got along just fine with the kids and the people. But the time when I was there in the 70s, the adults spoke the language, some of them fluently. And the kids spoke it brokenly, and they're still teaching Lakota language. And back there today, you don't hear as much of the language as you would have, pretty much. There's also rivalry between what you would call the full-bloods and the ones that are mixed bloods,
mm-hmm.
pretty much. You have that. But another thing, you didn't bring it up yet. You will. That is that at Wounded Knee, there were a number of soldiers there that had been at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, and they were just out for revenge.
That's right.
Big time, one way or the other.
That's right.
Well, that's about all I have to say.
Well, on the education front, I have to say that one of the great pleasures of working in this was the phenomenal photographs. And one of my favorite photographs of Pine Ridge is the group of teepees in the foreground, and behind it the school buildings that they've built, which are giant block-like buildings. And you just look at the two and you think, there's just no way that the people living in these teepees are ever going to be able to work with the people who built those buildings. You know, it was like looking at circles and squares and saying, this ain't never going to fit.
Eugene, thanks so much for that call and those insights. Appreciate it. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to get in touch and have your say, your comment, ask your question. Let's go to Port Wing and talk to KC next. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. How are you today?
Really good. Thank you.
Okay, awesome. I'd like to ask your author, you know, of course, we have to put everything in a late 19th century perspective. Okay, a lot of people think, oh, why did that happen? Well, it's not 2011 back then. It was 1891, and Native Americans weren't even second-class citizens. They weren't even considered citizens of our country. And on your last caller did touch on it. Of course, that was 7th Cavalry, and you know what happened in July 3rd and 4th, 1876. The 7th Cavalry. They sang a song of Gary Owen, and I would ask your author to check in Gary Owen because those people wanted payback. It was 40 below zero for the Native Americans. It was also 40 below zero for those soldiers, and they knew the quicker they wrapped things up, the quicker they could get somewhere where it was nice and warm. They didn't want to freeze to death either, but it was extremely ungodly thing that happened. And, of course, as you look at the long history of Wounded Knee, look how everything came around in a full circle. Look at 1971 and the AIM movement, and that happened at Wounded Knee, and the AIM movement made the Native Americans come forward in our culture. I'm not a Native American, but look at the Native Americans now. It took 200 years, but the Native Americans run big businesses in our country, and it really all, more or less, all started at Wounded Knee back in 1891 and 1971 with Dennis Means and the AIM movement. But I would ask your author, have you ever heard of Gary Owen?
Yes. In fact, when the troops actually pull out of South Dakota, they have a procession, which is there's a reporter there who gives this really florid, romantic portrait of these guys being marched out. And as they do that, when the 7th Cavalry goes through, they play Gary Owen. And when they do that, the general in charge of the whole thing takes his hat off, even though it's bitterly cold, and hangs it on the pommel of his saddle. And this is supposed to be the great symbol of what's happened in South Dakota. So Gary Owen comes back. And if listeners don't know the song Gary Owen, you can get versions of it played in the period style on YouTube. And it's definitely worth listening to. That was Custer's favorite song, and the 7th picked it up, and it became a symbol of Wounded Knee. You're absolutely right.
And, Casey, thanks for that call. 800-486-8655. A line is available for you right now, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the massacre at Wounded Knee 121 years later, and trying to get a handle on not just the how, but maybe the why, and wondering what you think. 800-486-8655. I read somewhere, and I'm trying to remember. As usual, I have too many pieces of paper in front of me here. I read somewhere that there are some that there have not been conclusive peace treaties made between the United States and some of the Sioux bands.
You know, the history of treaties between the different Indian tribes and the government is, I don't think anybody knows, they aren't incredibly messy. But I think probably what you're referring to is the fact that there were a number of treaties negotiated in 1867 and 1868, and both of them, 1867 and 1868, had clauses in 67 is the Treaty of Medicine Lodge, which is the Southern Plains tribes. And 1868 is the Treaty of Fort Laramie, which is the one that sweeps in the Lakota and the Northern Cheyenne, for example. And under the terms of both of those treaties, a certain percentage of the males of the tribe had to approve of any further land cessions. Off the top of my head, I believe it's 3/4. And nothing could be done unless 3/4 of the tribe agreed to lose more land or to sell more land. And in both cases, most of the land that the different tribes were accorded under those agreements has been taken away. And a case went before the Supreme Court as to whether or not, but it was Lone Wolf v. Hitchcock in the early 20th century, as to whether or not Congress had done that legally. And the Supreme Court, because it was pretty clear they hadn't, and the Supreme Court decided in favor of Congress for other reasons, basically because on the Supreme Court, it was a unanimous decision, was that Congress could do whatever it wanted with respect to a foreign power. Well, you can see why they had to come out that way, but what it meant was that Congress could do anything it wanted with any of the treaties that it had previously signed, so they had no force, is basically what the Lone Wolf v. Hitchcock decision decides. And what that means is that many people believe that the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie for the Lakota should still be in effect because it was abrogated, but it was abrogated illegally. In fact, 3/4 of the Sioux men did not approve of the loss of land in 1876, 1877, when they lost a great deal of it, or the later secession of the great vast majority of the a Great Sioux Reservation, which is essentially the whole western part of South Dakota, in 1889, which was done under the Harrison administration. If, in fact, that land were returned, it would dramatically change the entire landscape of the American West.
Well, the entire Indian way of life and their economy was pretty much destroyed by the westward movement of the white Europeans who were moving into the West, and the idea in Washington was we're going to take over everything. It's our destiny, and nobody's going to stop us. You had people like the Sherman family who were very much in favor of this. But their entire economy and way of life was destroyed in a matter of a little more than a decade or two.
Yes, and this goes back to what Eugene was saying, that the whole, you have to remember, of course, this is immediately after the Civil War. We sometimes forget that the Civil War affected the West as dramatically as it did, but it really was fought over the West. Things were pretty much stable in the East. It was over what was going to happen to the West. And when the North won the Civil War, what it did was that victory proved to Northern Americans that their economic system was the best one for America, but also the best one for the world. And, you know, when you talk about taking over the West, that is exactly what they planned to do. William Tecumseh Sherman actually gets moved from the Southern Theater to the Western Theater in the summer of 1865. He ends up being part of the negotiations to these treaties that force the different plains tribes, both north and south, so a railroad can go through the middle of the country. And later on, he says to his wife that he honestly believes that he does more good for the country by pushing the Indians out of the way in the West and settling the West than he ever did by subduing the South, that his real role was in the West. People tend to forget that. But when the North pushes this economy west, the idea that every man can make it on his own and work his way up, and nobody should be too rich, nobody should own slaves or own other human beings. They're pushing people, yes, but they really believe it. They believe that this is the best thing for themselves, for the country, and for the world. And you have to remember, too, this is a period when immigrants are flooding into America, begging for that way of life. And it never occurs to them that this is not really the best thing for everybody. So that anybody who disagrees with them and tries to hold on to their own communal economy, for example, like Eugene is talking about, doesn't seem to be offering an alternative plan. They just seem to be hostile or stupid or unable to understand why this is simply a great thing. So they really can't see that this might not be the best thing for everybody or for the country. Of course, the huge irony here is that that economy works very well in the East, but in the West, it never was a very good fit, and that's how we end up with having such water problems in the West and the Dust Bowl and all sorts of things, because that whole extractive economy doesn't actually work terribly well in the Western economy. What worked well was what the Indians had set up, but that was something that people like William Tecumseh Sherman and his brother Senator John Sherman simply couldn't see, and not just because they were blind, but because of the way the world looked to them coming out of the Civil War.
Here's an email from Steve in Madison who writes, do professional U.S. historians ever use the term genocide in speaking of the treatment of Native Americans? Have U.S. politicians ever spoken in Congress of U.S. treatment of Native Americans as genocide? And what would be the international repercussions in terms of reparations of a charge of genocide by the United States against Native Americans?
That's a great question. And yes, historians do talk about genocide having to do with the relationship between what I in this book have called Americans and Native Americans, Indian tribes. I am not one to like the word genocide in that context because personally, and I am not a genocide historian, personally, it seems to me that genocide should be purposeful on behalf, usually on behalf of a government. And most of the true devastation that happens early on is caused by disease. And, of course, nobody understands disease until the 1880s with the arrival of germ theory. So a lot of the truly horrific numbers of dead, and they are horrific, is not, I won't say unintentional, it's not like the Europeans coming in think it's a bad idea, but they don't actually know what they're doing. there is an exception to that, and that is immediately after the gold rush in 1848 when miners flood into California. Then they really do hunt down and kill all the California Indians they can find. That is a targeted, deliberate, let's shoot these guys down, and they do it. So that's my take on that. Whether people have talked about it in Congress or not, I have not seen it discussed as specifically as a discussion about genocide. That's not to say it's not there, although I am a congressional historian. I have not read the congressional record for the 20th century. I do know that that word is really not used in the 19th century, but they do talk in Congress about how you're killing all these people on purpose. But that's a very much a political ploy, and it gets very little traction. What the international repercussions of that would be quite big, I think. If you think about the huge fight we had over the word refugee a few years ago, what actually constituted a refugee, nowadays it seems to me that the repercussions of a word like genocide are huge. I mean, look at the fact we're still not using, the government is still not using that word, I believe, about Armenia. I think that would be huge. So I wouldn't hold my breath that it's going to happen anytime soon.
I guess there were politicians at the time who basically were calling for the extermination of the Indians.
That's correct. In the 19th century, absolutely, and before. I mean, really, starting from the very beginning of European settlement in America. I'm sorry, not the Spanish so much, but on the East Coast of America. Absolutely, people thought that it would be simpler just to kill everyone off. And Williams Tecumseh Sherman talks that way, both before the Civil War and after the Civil War. Those impulses are always balanced out by people who say, what on earth are you talking about? You can't go kill everybody. And those two impulses are very much at war throughout the 18th and 19th centuries in America and into the 20th century. And it does not become a deliberate part of the of the government's policies in a way that, to me, that genocide would imply. You know, that being said, you hear a lot about the Pine Ridge Reservation being called prisoner of war camp something. As near as I can tell, that's an urban legend. I actually spent a great deal of time trying to chase that down this fall, and I have found no records where that is, no official records where they call it a prisoner of war camp. That being said, certainly prisoners of war were held at those sites in the 19th century because they were held in military forts, which were all over the reservations. But I don't believe there was any evidence I could find. That's not to say it's not necessarily there. I did look fairly concertedly for it, that the government said, we're going to turn this place into a prisoner of war camp, and we're going to kill the people who are there. Prisoner of war camps and concentration camps really are a product of the Cuban crisis in 1898, which is pretty much later than any of the stuff we're talking about.
Here's an email from Ken in Waupaca who asks, who writes, Wounded Knee and Pine Ridge, a good place to visit. Is it true that our military at the time experimented with early automatic or machine gun type weapons at Wounded Knee? And also, has the U.S. government ever officially apologized for the massacre at Wounded Knee? Well, let's talk about the guns first. They had four Hotchkiss guns, but were they the sort of five-barrel repeating guns, or were they the small, the light artillery pieces so popular with the cavalry?
They were light artillery pieces. They did have a revolving set of, I'm drawing a blank on the word, of cartridges.
There was a five-barrel model that fired 32-millimeter cartridges, I believe, and they were quite popular with the cavalry because they had a lot of firepower, and they could reach a lot farther than a regular rifle.
And that's exactly right. That's what they're using is the mountain guns. Were they? It's an interesting question. Is that where they tried them out? No. There's a big fight among the officers about what kind of weaponry they could get, and that's that. And the guy in charge was furious. He couldn't get more than he got. But your point is not, Ken. Your point is not ill taken in that. The Wounded Knee was where the military was trying out a bunch of stuff it had never done before. It becomes a pivotal military moment as well as Indian history moment because the military has not fully mobilized since the Civil War. And, I mean, this is one of the things I find so incredible about this story, is that a third of the U.S. Army goes into South Dakota in November, right before this terrible winter of 1890, to put down a group of Indians who have not committed any murders or stolen any property. So, you know, you realize there's something else going on than simply we got to take care of hostile Indians. No one's died. Nothing's been taken. Why did a third of the Army go in? And that's one question, but the Army definitely sees it as an opportunity to try out a lot of new stuff. And for me, one of the most interesting pieces that I did not have room to talk about in this book, but there is a good book out there, is this is where the Army tries out its new medical supplies for the first time, because this is the first major mobilization since the Army has understood germ theory. So there's a fascinating diary of a doctor who goes out there with his clean bandages and his clean operating instruments for the first time, and tries to look at infections and what's going to happen. And he's very excited because it's the first time he gets to use all the new Army tents and all the new medical supplies. So it is a moment where the Army is saying, look, we're going to be a modern Army, and what does that entail? And the guy who runs the Hotchkiss guns and points them down the ravine ends up going on to teach military tactics at MIT, becoming one of their first professors of military tactics. So it really is a pivotal new moment. Has Congress apologized? Not to my knowledge, and that's quite a sore point, because, of course, many people know that after the massacre, the Harrison administration gives out a number of medals of honor. They are not congressional medals of honor in this era. They are medals of honor. And a large number of them, go to people who had fought at Wounded Knee and in the battles immediately after it. They do that for a number of reasons, but there are many people, and I am among them, who think that medals of honor, even in an era when medals of honor were given basically to anyone who asked for one, should not have been given to people who trained Hotchkiss guns on women and children. Those medals have not been rescinded. Sometimes medals are, but those medals never have been, and that is brought up in Congress pretty much every year, and every year nobody really talks about it. I know there's always a campaign to have those medals taken away.
We're talking about Wounded Knee, 121 years removed. And we have some phone callers. There are some more emails we want to get to. Yours could be next. There's a line available for you at 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. My guest this hour is Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College, author of Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. Of course, this is the 121st anniversary of this horrible event. We have a lot of people who want to talk to us on the phone. Let's go to Viroqua first and talk with Teresa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Teresa.
I'm a writer, too, and I've finished a screenplay over the course of the past couple of years about the Donner Party going across the Oregon Trail. And, you know, when they were in Fort Laramie, they had nothing but wonderful, beautiful encounters with the Lakota. They went buffalo hunting. They were invited to breakfast with the chiefs. They had the chiefs up at the fort for festivities and whatnot. And, you know, so I'm kind of curious as to how things devolved to the point of the slaughters when the Lakota really were peaceful, at least in terms of the pioneers heading west, and quite curious about the culture that was coming across and willing to share their riches and their culture with the white people coming across. That's one of my questions. But my other question has to do with what's gone on with the American Indian movement and the overreaction of the government to, you know, this small handful of protesters, the murder of John Trudell's family and the incarceration, ongoing incarceration of Leonard Peltier. It just seems like an overreaction again and again and again from the American government, even into modern times. And I wonder if it does relate to the overreaction that occurred back in the 1800s.
Both good questions. Remind me, when was the Donner Party?
1846.
1846. Boy, there's wonderful stuff on that, isn't there?
Yeah, it really is.
And there's wonderful stuff, by the way, later on from Fort Laramie. There's a reporter who's there in Fort Laramie who has great stuff. If you ever want to exchange materials, get in touch with me, because there's wonderful material on that stuff. In fact, it's enormously ironic, because the Lakota, in fact, do, for the most part, have a very good relationship, at least by the in the period you're talking about, in the 1840s, and then later on by the 1880s, 1890s, they have a quite a decent relationship with the settlers and with the army officers around them. What happens in this peculiar way in 1888, 1889 is really a function of the fact there is a new gang in town, if you will. When the Harris administration is elected in 1888, it's elected with 100,000 fewer votes than the popular vote, and it knows it's in terrible trouble to try and preserve the Republican lock on the American government going forward, and they feel the desperate need to do that because the Republican administration is the one that's promoting big business, and in the late 19th century, there is a sense that unless you protect big business, you're going to destroy the American economy. And the Democrats are threatening to cut that legislation down, and this all centers around the tariff. So when the Harris administration gets in, it is desperate to preserve its lock on the government, and it knows it can't do that because it doesn't have the votes it needs to. So the very first thing it does, that the Harrison people do, is they admit four new states to the U.S. government. If anybody's ever wondered how we got four states in a little over a week, in 1889, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Washington, we got those because the Harrison administration was convinced they would vote Republican and send eight new Republican senators to Washington to hang on to control of the government. So that even if the Democrats got the House of Representatives, they couldn't get the Senate, and therefore the high tariffs would be preserved. Of course, if you know the history of it, you know the problem with that is that South Dakota, the new state that they have built out of the old Dakota Territory, which was North and South Dakota, is largely owned by the Lakota. So they have to get the Lakota out of the way fast. And regardless of the Treaty of Fort Laramie of 1868, regardless of the history, regardless of the fact that there really aren't a lot of people who want to live in South Dakota in 1889, they keep hoping there are, but there really aren't that many. Regardless of all those things, they have to get the Lakota out fast. And when they do that, when they negotiate the land agreement of 1889, you know, it doesn't go real well. The Lakota don't want to give up their lands, and the U.S. government wants it very badly. And one of the things that the Harrison administration starts to do is to portray the Lakota as being hostile and as being under the control of the old hostile leaders who fought the Battle of Little Bighorn, for example, or the Battle of the Greasy Grass, as the Lakota knew it. So the tensions start to rise, but they're still, you know, the Lakota are a beaten people at that point. They don't have an economy. They can't feed themselves. They really kind of have to do what they're told. A few of them talk a good game still, but for the most part, they're stuck on the reservations. And then all of the attempts to fix the election of 1890 don't work. Not only does the Harris administration let in those first four states, the next year it lets in two more, Idaho and Wyoming. That's how we got those two states. Six states in less than a year, which I think is absolutely fascinating and can't believe that nobody's ever wondered why that happened before. But that doesn't work. And when that happens, in order to shore up the fortunes of the Republican Party before the 1890 election, when it looks very much like it's going to lose, Harrison puts a number of new Indian agents into the Lakota reservation. He does not put in people who actually want to be on the Lakota reservations. He puts on politicians who will subcontract out very valuable contracts to political supporters. Those people who go on those reservations, there's two of them primarily, and Daniel Royer is the name that other people will have heard. Oh, there's another one, too. But when those guys go onto the reservations, they are immediately terrified. They hate Indians. They don't understand them. They are convinced from the minute they step on the reservations that the Indians are out to get them and out to be hostile. And those are the telegrams they start to write. Those are the newspaper interviews they start to give. And this sense builds in the East that the Lakota are dangerous and on the warpath, they keep saying. I mean, this is completely not true. Like I said, there's no lives lost until after the army goes in. But that's the image and the rhetoric that starts in the papers. And it's funny. The South Dakota history has a wonderful diary of a settler, a couple of brothers who had what's called the Orlock Ranch in South Dakota while all this is going on. And they're writing in their diary going, you know, we don't know what state they're talking about because South Dakota doesn't, we don't have any trouble with our Lakota neighbors. I mean, they stop by, they use our oven, we're getting along fine with them. We have no idea where this is coming from, that we're in danger. They didn't carry their guns with them when they went out to check their fence lines. They weren't worried. But the newspapers and the administration gets the idea that the Lakota are, in fact, out to kill settlers through these crazy agents, one of whom is almost certainly a drug addict by the time he is on the reservation. He certainly is one within 5 years. So these are really unreliable reporters. As for the overreaction in the AIM movement, yes, I think there is a long history of overreaction. One of the problems with dealing with the government and the government, the American people, and the American Indians is that American Indians have always been dealt with by the government through a different set of government organizations than American citizens have been. So there's always this weird chain of command that might not actually be paying the right kinds of attention and might be overreacting or reacting to a completely different set of stimuli than an American citizen would be dealing with. So so that's a much harder thing to tease out, and it's not, as I say, it's not just about overreaction, sort of cultural reaction, I think, that you and I would think about and react to. But there's the Interior Department, there's congressional committees who may or may not meet. Last year I was quite horrified that when the reservations were literally powerless, they lost all their power and they couldn't get food because the snows were so bad, I believe the congressional committees that were charged with the oversight of those reservations didn't even bother to meet, which I thought was absolutely outrageous. But so they have congressional committees, they have the Interior Department, they have a different set of treaties. It's a much longer story to untangle than it is if, say, the U.S. Army turns against strikers in the coal mines, where they're actually dealing with U.S. citizens and a certain chain of command that is the one that I, as a non-Indian, am most familiar with.
Teresa, thanks for the call. We need to move on because we've got quite a few more phone calls to get and just about 3 minutes left to try and do it. Let's go to Milwaukee next. And Ron, you're up. Ron, good morning.
Yes. I wanted to ask if you could draw parallels between that time and Wounded Knee and our recent excursion into other countries and our fear of, like you mentioned, the fear of Indians, the military, not knowing who they were. And now we're doing excursions into Iraq and Vietnam and all these other things. So there seems to be the parallels, and I wondered if the elements that drive the American people to support or be privy to these things are still going on.
I would say that it is a terrible, terrible error ever to overlook the imperatives of politicians who want to hang on to power. Certainly in American history, I mean, I really can't speak for other countries, but as an American historian, I think anybody who does not look at who benefits from a military excursion and who is hurt is looking at the wrong questions. I hope that gives you enough of an answer.
Well, I was thinking when you were talking about Harrison's appointment of the Indian agents of some of the things that happened in Iraq immediately after we went in there. In terms of the appointment of people who turned out not to actually know what they were doing, but they had good political credentials.
That's a constant in American history, and that's one of the reasons that in the late 19th century, and actually Harrison's predecessor and successor, Cleveland, who was on either side of him, was very much behind the idea of civil service, the idea that we needed trained bureaucrats as opposed to political appointees, because political appointees might be brilliant, but the chances are good, the reason that they're put in a position are because they share an ideology and they are able to deliver votes. And as we know from looking not only at America but at other countries, if you want to run a country well, as opposed to running a political party well, you want people who know their jobs. And I think for the most of us, we want people who can run a country well, not necessarily a political party.
Wow. Well, that's a whole other show. And I've got, I probably have two pages of questions I didn't get to here, and I'm sure we'll revisit this issue again because it's still being discussed. I really appreciate your time this morning, Professor. It's been another enlightening conversation.
Thank you so much, John.
Heather Cox Richardson, Professor of History at Boston College. She's the author of Wounded Knee, Party Politics and the Road to an American Massacre. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Thanks to Rhonda for getting another great guest here this morning. Chrissy Pease handled on-air production duties for us. If you would like to listen to this program again, you can go to our website, WPR.org. Go to the Kathleen Dunn Show page, and you should be able to listen to the show all over again. Kathleen will be back next week. I'll be doing other stuff. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.